I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University boasts an impressive fleet of flight simulation technology. As students progress through their flight education, the simulation labs at Embry-Riddle give them a hands-on experience at the possible jobs they might get after graduating. Intersection's Brendan Byrne toured the facility and some of those simulation labs. He joins me now in the studio. Brendan, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
So tell me about this tour. Where did you start?
Well, the tour started from the ground, so to speak, in the air traffic control simulation lab. Lou Higgins is a retired air traffic controller, and he runs this lab at Embry-Riddle. Here he is explaining what students learn in his lab.
We teach the students how to control airplanes in an en route environment with radar and also without radar. What happens if the power goes out and you lose radar? There are a specific set of rules that are for non-radar, and we teach that as well as radar procedures in the en route environment in this lab.
So obviously radar is pretty critical to air traffic control. If you lose that, how do you land an airplane?
Well, Higgins says very carefully. He says his students learn the protocol developed by the FAA to do just that.
Well, that's reassuring. So do you have just air traffic control students practicing in the simulator, or are there other folks in there too?
No, both air traffic control and flight students go through Higgins' lab. I'm going to let him explain why.
Well, it can serve two purposes. It can be a backup in case something doesn't work out in the flying industry, or it also gives them a view of what's on the other side. When I'm talking to an air traffic controller, why did he do this? Well, if they take a course in air traffic, they much better understand why that was done or why that instruction was given or why they have to hold and so on and so forth. It's not like a blind sort of thing.
He went on to say the technology in his lab simulates things to almost 100% of the real world. So students who think they want to get into air traffic controlling can see if this is right for them.
So, Brendan, what part does technology play in all of this?
Well, this is something that I learned during my tour at Embry-Riddle, but simulation technology is scalable. So basically, whatever you can imagine, you can simulate. Here's Higgins again.
In a simulation like this, we can do all kinds of good stuff. We can make it snow in Daytona Beach if we want to. Behind us is a scenario that's set up for dark. And then we have another set over here. It's raining. And it'll show the lightning and all kinds of good stuff.
Well, that's interesting. Air traffic control, an industry that's been around for a while, but when I think simulation, I think of flight simulators, you know, things that allow you to envisage or figure out what it's like to fly a plane. So what about that new flight technology?
Well, you're right. That my next stop was the suborbital simulation lab. So think of companies like Virgin Galactic and X-Core Aerospace. They're developing vehicles that can take humans to low Earth orbit for a low cost. And in the suborbital lab, the team at Embry-Riddle converted an old Cessna into a simulation of one of these suborbital spacecraft. Lab technician Nicholas Karlstrom invited me to fly with him on one of these simulations. Here he is to explain some of the displays we were looking at.
Here displayed on the cockpit monitors is the instrument panel that is set to resemble one that we would see in our suborbital spaceflight vehicle. Some of the most critical displays, such, you know, our fuel gauges, maps and navigational system, G-force measurements.
So this is a simulator for future pilots?
Not just for future pilots. Embry-Riddle's working with Project Possum. They're a group of scientists that are studying clouds in the upper atmosphere. These clouds are only reachable by suborbital vehicles. They're training scientists to ride in the cockpit of these vehicles to help pilot the vehicle and perform science experiments.
Uh-huh. Kind of like a scientific co-pilot.
Exactly. And Karlstrom invited me into that right seat as a payload specialist during simulation. Here's some tape of us taking off.
So here, thrusters up. We're taking off the brakes. We're going to increase speed to about 220 knots. Here we are. Pitch up. About 10 degrees until we leave the surface of the runway. We retract our landing gear. Now we orient the vehicle at about an 85 degree pitch up and exit the atmosphere as quickly as possible.
Okay, so this simulator, as you say, based on a Cessna, but clearly not a, a propeller plane. It's you're going at 80 degrees up. I mean, that sounds pretty intense.
Yeah, there's a big rocket that they light underneath the thing to get you out of the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like? What was it like being in there?
Well, it's really immersive. There's screens that surround the front of the cockpit. It really makes it seem like you're flying. The graphics are top-notch, and most importantly, it's loud. You mm-hmm. feel like you're really in that thing.
Did you get airsick?
I did not, no.
Uh-huh. What other simulation labs did you see, Brandon?
Well, the next one was really cool. It's the Unmanned Aircraft Systems Lab. As you may know, this is a booming industry. Embry-Riddle teaches students commercial, non-military applications of unmanned aircraft. Here's Assistant Professor John Robbins talking about some of those applications.
We don't focus on military application. We focus on civil application. So we look at what industry is doing, and we do things like border patrols. We do things like searching for a particular asset in a location, things like that.
And here's John Bounds. He's a former Embry-Riddle student who worked in the UAS industry, and now he's back running the lab. This is some of the things he teaches his students.
We have an oil spill cleanup mission that we do. We have a search and rescue where we find some lost hikers in a wooded area. We have a criminal chase where somebody's breaking into a building and they run away from the building. We have to follow the individuals. All civilian applications that we work on.
Mm-hmm. So this kind of beyond what the military is doing with these unmanned vehicles, there's pretty wide range of applications there. So, Brendan, how are these simulators preparing students for the real world?
Well, Robin says they do a really great job at preparing them. They boast a high job placement rate after the program, and he says that's because the classroom is almost identical to the real world.
The job in this case is a virtual classroom. This setting represents what they would actually see when they go out into industry. These simulators were very, there's a high level of technology associated with them. They were developed by a company that works with this type of simulation, and the operation of these particular aircraft are like they would be in industry. So it prepares them really well.
Okay, so Brendan, you took a trip in the suborbital simulator. You had a look around the simulation center for air traffic controllers. What else did you get to check out?
Well, my last stop was the Advanced Flight Simulator Training Facility, where I actually got to fly one of these simulators. It's in a massive building filled with these kind of half domes with the front half of a Cessna in the middle of them, and projectors are overhead. They give the pilot in the cockpit 220 degrees of simulated surroundings so you can look from one shoulder to the other and kind of see the landscape. I hopped into the pilot seat with Professor Michael Wiggins. Here we are taking off.
We'll add power a little bit slower. Light pressures. There you go. There you go. Okay. A little bit more back to the right.
Okay.
More back to the right. You got to overcome some of the turning tendencies caused by the engine and the torque
gotcha.
And stuff. Okay. Now we're up to this speed, so we're going to pull back about where this is even with the horizon. Okay.
So you got to take off in a Cessna. Were you able to land it as well?
I was.
Mm-hmm. And they say that's the trickiest part
that
of flying,
That is the hardest,
right?
Yes.
So it really felt like you were flying, Brendan Byrne?
It did. It wasn't like a video game joystick or even a controller. The controls were firm. They responded to the plane. I could turn my head, look over one wing, and see the speedway, the beach, the pier. And with that projector around me, it really did feel like we were flying. My instructor was telling me that simulator sickness is a real thing. You can get queasy in these things, mm-hmm. And it's something that they're studying at Embry-Riddle.
So how did you get on?
Pretty good. My instructor said I was a natural, so maybe a career in flying is in my future.
Well, for now, Brendan is still Intersections producer. He was recently at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University reporting on their simulation labs. Brendan, thank you so much for joining me and telling us about that tour.
My pleasure, Matt. Thanks.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. When we come back, a panel of experts discusses what makes the simulation industry tick and what makes Orlando the hub for this booming industry. Intersection continues after a short break. Modeling and simulation are big business in Central Florida. The industry boasts a workforce of 30,000 people, and it's worth about $5 billion a year. That's according to the Florida High Tech Corridor, a partnership between community colleges, universities, and economic development organizations that aims to grow the high tech industry here in Central Florida. Well, simulation is applied in a range of professions, medicine, the military, theme parks, and it has deep roots in Orlando, where the National Center for Simulation is based, the epicenter of the modeling, simulation, and training industry, linking national defense, government, and industry. Thousands of experts will converge onto Orlando tomorrow for the start of the Florida Simulation Summit. And to talk about what's hot in this booming industry, we'll speak to retired General Tom Baptiste from the National Simulation Center, Dr. Shiva Kaladindi from Nemours Children's Hospital, and Michael Schontz, Director of Technology and Analysis, Design and Engineering at Disney. But before we look at the industry-wide, let's start with the story of one company. Robert Abascal is the CEO and founder of AVT Simulation, a simulation firm in Orlando. Welcome to Intersection, Robert.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Let's start with what your company does. What do you do?
We work on military simulators. Military simulators have been in use since the 70s and early 80s. Mm-hmm. They're getting a little long in the tooth, so we continue to support them so they can deliver training to our military.
I was looking at your website, and I see you have a simulation trainer or some software for mid-air refueling. Now, I'm no pilot, but that looks like one of the most difficult things you could do in flying, essentially trying to gas up your plane mid-air. How did you discover there was a niche for this kind of simulation?
Through our Air Force customers, we specialize in visual technology. The primary stimulus in man-in-the-loop simulation mm-hmm. applications is the visual. So Applied Visual Technology, AVT. So we were upgrading the visual systems, and one of the hardest tasks actually is the aerial refueling part. What's more amazing than, you know, tying up a big tanker with a multi-million dollar fighter jet is that there are 19-year-old kids doing this.
Really?
So what's amazing with the training is that we're training literally kids off the street. Within five sorties, they're doing that task. So it's an amazing trainer.
And you note on the website that a good thing about using simulation software is you're not going to damage your plane.
Right.
So how did you get started, especially dealing with the military? It's a pretty specialized sort of field. You have a background in the defense industry?
Yeah, I guess it's right place at the right time. Came out of school before revolution in telecommunications, and that's what I specialized in. But simulation really came to the forefront early 80s. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. And it is, I would call it somewhat specialized, but it's fun. I found it fun. It's computer programming, system engineering, mechanical engineering. But you can really see the results of your work in an somewhat entertaining way.
Is having some kind of military background, is that what it takes to get into this industry?
No, not at all. Just as far as engineering goes, it's just math, and more math, mm-hmm. physics, that sort of thing.
Was it ever the case, though, that if you'd had some kind of foothold in the military, that would give you some assistance in getting into this field?
I think it certainly would help. We rely on military subject matter experts to help our engineers accomplish what they need to do.
So, Robert Abascal, why does Orlando work for you as far as your company and how that fits in?
I was actually stranded in Texas where we were making fighter jets and helicopters using simulation. That was a cost center for them. Orlando is the place to be because it's a revenue generation. So the business model is completely different when you're an expense to a company versus revenue to a company. And it's the epicenter of simulation, primarily military. Now there's other applications, but the Army customers here and the Navy and the Marines as well.
How about finding skilled workers? Is it a challenge to find the kind of engineers and folks you need to make your company work?
Not in our area. It is getting competitive. So salaries are very competitive to find really good people. And the really good ones are valuable employees, so you want to keep a hold of them. But it is getting competitive to try to attract and retain that talent. Now with the UCF here, great school. I have specialized programs and simulations, so we have internship programs with UCF, and they are phenomenal students that come out of that university.
What does a job in this field pay?
Entry would be in the 60s, low 60s, all the way up to 120. Now, we're a small business. The bigger businesses could and do offer more, and that's where we would lose some of our people for higher salaries. But there's a trade-off between salary and quality of life, let's just say.
Sure.
So I would say medium would be 85,000.
And how quickly is the simulation industry changing? You alluded to that at the start of our conversation, but how much change have you seen?
It's very interesting times. I'm from the military simulation realm. The older simulations, the older training systems have already been declared end of life. So we've never really experienced an end of life situation for a deployed training system. So that's a new experience. So what's next? And those wheels are already in motion. So it's right now in the early envisioning stage, funding yet to follow. So it's pretty exciting. The military invested heavily in technology. In the 70s, it was computer graphics and simulations and computers and that sort of thing to develop these training systems. That's been commercialized, and one could argue that the gaming industry, which is a multi-billion dollar industry, mm-hmm. the movie, the entertainment industry, a lot of computer graphics, that's come full circle now where the military is looking at commercially developed technologies such as the cloud
right.
to support their training needs. So that's an exciting application where the military isn't footing the entire bill, and they're leveraging the best of the commercial world for their training needs.
Well, let's bring in retired General Tom Baptiste. He's the president of the National Center for Simulation, headquartered at Research Park in Orlando. Tom Baptiste, the National Center for Simulation has been here since 1993. What was the intent of the center when it was formed, and how has that changed in the last 22-some years?
In the early days, the idea was to find a way to spin off or transfer the technology that the military had spent a lot of R&D dollars on to applications for the basic housewife. So it was all about how do we commercialize proven technology that the military has used for years.
Mm-hmm. Did you have some examples of that?
Well, no, because I wasn't here.
Right.
It was a long time ago. But the White House put some money on the table in a defense reinvestment grant. The local community in Orange County and the surrounding counties and the legislature matched some of that money. The university joined. Then Martin Marietta was the biggest defense contractor. They put some matching funds on the table. And they stood up an organization called the Training and Simulation Consortium. And its whole idea was to find ways to spin off that technology. So they hired about 25 engineers. They did studies. They did analysis. They tried to do everything they could. But to be honest with you, the timing wasn't right because the boon in simulation across all of the four services was just too lucrative for industry. Industry wasn't interested in commercial applications. There was mm-hmm. too much opportunity to build devices to support the training of our military people. And so it sort of failed. But over the years, NCS has transformed itself into a regional trade association that represents industry. So we promote the industry in Central Florida. We bring academia, industry, and government to the same table to try to continue to grow, enhance, and support the industry in every way. We work with local schools from middle to colleges and universities to grow the workforce. So we're very much in support of the industry as the head cheerleader.
Is the military still the biggest customer for simulation?
Absolutely. There are some very innovative companies that are members of NCS that are looking at other ways to expand their customer portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, it's other government agencies such as Homeland Security or FEMA. The way you train first responders is not unlike training a large formation of soldiers. So using proven simulation technology, computer-generated exercises, you can train in wide expanse of geography, and you change the scenario from combat to a earthquake or a hurricane, natural disaster. And you can train those first responders using proven simulation that was developed for the military. But also in transportation, homeland mm-hmm. security, education, as Robert talked about, digital media, serious gaming, leveraging games to generate immersive types of simulations for mm-hmm. serious training and education, not for fun.
Some of those immersive types of situations, those are now coming from outside of, like some of the advances would be coming from outside of the military though, right?
Well, I think if you look at the beginning of the gaming industry, it sort of spun off from military simulation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, as Robert said, it's coming full circle, and the military is leveraging the power of game engines, which for a reasonable price, you can get the rights to use the engine. You repopulate the game with serious material, and you can create an immersive environment that looks just like an urban environment in Afghanistan or Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And you can put a single soldier or several soldiers in that immersed environment, and they can practice their craft in a safe and secure environment using that immersive simulation.
So, Tom Baptiste, why is Orlando the center? Was it an accident, or what is it that makes Orlando the place for simulation?
Well, it all goes back 50 years when the Army and the Navy working together moved here to the old Naval Training Center that is now Baldwin Park. It's been closed. Mm-hmm. But the big boon came when the city fathers in Orlando, Orange County, and the state legislature had a vision to build a research park adjacent to UCF. So in an area of land just south of the university that was nothing but orange groves and palmetto bushes, they offered the Department of the Navy 40 acres free of charge to build a center of excellence for modeling, simulation, and training. Mm-hmm. The Navy took the option. They built it a Flores complex and the base, which is called Naval Support Activity Orlando. That is now the anchor tenet around which the research park has grown over the last 30 years. And by any measure, the research park here in Central Florida is in the top 10 in America. And the reason for that is because that Naval Support Activity Orlando, that military and government presence, buys nearly $5 billion worth of simulation training and technology annually, mm-hmm. which is very attractive to Robert and other industry. That predictable funding, they flock to the research park. There are 100 for-profit corporations just in the research park alone, mm-hmm. probably 150 to 200 along the I-4 corridor.
This is kind of a real estate story in some ways.
Well, it really is. It was the wisdom of somebody to say that if we're going to build a research park and expect the best and the brightest and research funding and all those things to come, we have to have an anchor tenant that makes it very lucrative. Mm-hmm. And it was lucrative to build that base, which now is the engine that drives the simulation industry in Florida.
So you talk about funding there. Federal funding is very important. How reliable is it, though?
Well, we're not immune to the budget battles on Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. But the way I talk about it is there will never be zero requirement for training. So in austere budget environment, if you're looking for ways to save money, simulation is a cost-effective alternative to live training, which is very expensive. So there will never be zero requirement for training. There will be more requirement for effective simulation in order to meet the limited budgets that are available to the four services. So I think we're in a very stable environment. We will continue to receive funding because you can't – in this budget environment, you can't just say, no, we're going to cut simulation. You'll be cutting your feet off.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's bring in Michael Schontz. He's the Director of Technology and Analysis Design and Engineering at Disney. Michael Schontz, how does Disney use simulation?
So this has been a effort over the last, say, 15 years that I've tried to bring online here at Disney. So I'm an old aerospace guy, like when Tom and Robert were talking. Brought back a lot of memories back when I was working in aerospace. So back in the 80s and 90s, I worked on Silicon Graphics high-speed computer systems back when that was the simulation high-end platform. And we did a lot of analysis using these tools and these high-end techniques. But because of the cost that's involved in utilizing simulation back in that time, it hadn't been utilized across a lot of different various industries. But that's all changed. Like what they were saying, we can now leverage a lot of these tools and this effort that's come online to be able to use this in our industry. And so when I got here and I started working on one of the rides, I said, well, where's the system simulation for this? And there was kind of this blank look, like, what are you talking about? Because in the aerospace world, if you're not doing a simulation, it's going to be very difficult to fly things and make sure that they do things correctly. But, you know, in the entertainment industry, a lot of times you build things and then you see how they end up working out. But we're starting to implement more of a model-based design methodology. Mm-hmm. So the idea is to build a simulation environment, get an idea about how things are going to work, and then essentially tune them in the virtual environment and design them in that environment. And then that way you'll have a much better understanding about what the actual ride system, show system, animation, parade system, however that is going to look, feel, and appear to all of our guests.
So if you're saying you're talking about designing a roller coaster, you would start with a simulation and then go from there?
And that's what we're starting to do more and more now, mm-hmm. because the tools are available to do so. It didn't always used to be that way. When you look back at the previous industry back in aerospace, you used to require hundreds, thousands of engineers. So many of these tools now have gotten much easier to use, much more sophisticated, that you can have a much smaller staff to be able to do pretty much the same type of work. And so that way it's being leveraged across all these different industries.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like things are changing pretty rapidly in the theme park industry, as with military simulation.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about our guests, right, they're going to be expecting more and more immersive types of experiences. And so we have to deliver those. And then we want them always to come back. So we want to have more and exciting types of attractions and guest feelings that they can look back at and experience with all their families.
It seems, too, though, that a lot of the theme parks, they're just going bigger. I mean, some of these roller coasters are colossal now, right? And they're...
Yeah. And, you know, when you look at true, like, amusement parks, certainly it's always going to be bigger and faster and that kind of thing. But when you think about it, of course, from Disney perspective, it's all about immersing yourself into the storyline, right? And so there's all these other aspects that are going on. There's the animated figures. There's the show that you're trying to tell, the feeling that you're trying to invoke amongst people that are entering in that facility. And so when you pull all that together, the more that you can analyze and understand how all of that's going to work together, the more likely that that experience is going to be something that's going to be very exciting.
So, Michael Shantz, can you give us a sneak peek of what we might see in the next 5 to 10 years at theme parks directly as a result of simulation?
Well, I certainly can't talk about details amongst exact attractions. What I can tell you is that we're going to be doing some pretty exciting things, and we're certainly going to be leveraging simulation analysis techniques to be able to do that. We're getting ready to open a park in Shanghai. We have members of our team that are embedded in that group right now that have been using simulation analysis techniques to help bring those rides and shows online, and they're bringing that in to do that as part of the testing. So as like Robert and Tom were talking about, as far as like understanding about how things will work ahead of time and training and everything that's associated with that, the more that we can do that testing offline, the more successful we'll be when we go actually out to the facility and then do that testing.
When you talk about simulation, the way it's used in theme parks, what about sort of the way crowds, because, I mean, Disney, other theme parks deal with massive numbers of people every day.
Yeah.
So is simulation kind of help you guide those people through the park as well? So
we utilize a number of different techniques. So some of the dynamics types techniques that I was talking about earlier as far as ride dynamics from coasters and animated figures, and we do very detailed mechanical dynamics, finite element analysis, velocities and accelerations, understand how all that happens. But the other piece that you're alluding to is what we think of as agent-based modeling. This actually falls in line, I'm sure, with some of the work that probably Robert and Tom are both familiar with. This is where you have what we call representations of humans, and they have a certain artificial intelligence, brains, if you will.
Right.
But there's also the 3D environment that exists amongst themselves, how they interact with this 3D environment, and then they end up walking around that. But they interact with them with other people, and they interact with the environment around them. And so you can start building up that representation of the human beings and then understand how they all interact with each other and then build a much, much bigger model to understand how people will interact both with the attractions and amongst themselves to understand things like, are there going to be bottlenecks? Do you have enough interactive areas to keep people busy in what they're thinking about doing? So that's kind of like the agent-based modeling realm.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Our conversation about simulation in Central Florida continues after a short break. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about the modeling, simulation, and training industry in Central Florida. With me in the studio, Robert Abascal, CEO and founder of AVT Simulation, retired General Tom Baptiste, president of the National Center for Simulation in Orlando, Michael Shantz, director of technology and analysis, design, and engineering for Walt Disney, and joining the conversation, Dr. Shiva Kalandindi from Nemours Children's Hospital. Dr. Kalandindi, what are a couple of ways that your hospital is using simulation?
Simulation is a great opportunity within the hospital setting. At Nemours, we utilize simulation to help improve patient safety and quality of care. And to give specific examples, one of the unique ways that we are utilizing simulation is helping educate patients and families how to better take care of themselves and their loved ones. Kids undergo several procedures and go home with medical appliances to help deliver healthcare for them. And many a times they are uncomfortable having to troubleshoot issues that might arise out of having those devices hooked to them. We utilize simulation for them to be able to practice on mannequins, which are high fidelity and low fidelity based on their needs, they are able to practice it, troubleshoot it with the expertise that is provided by the specialist. And then they feel so much more comfortable when they go home to be able to take care of the loved ones.
Can you give us an example of where a parent had to take a kid home and like what kind of equipment might they be dealing with?
Some kids, especially medically complex conditions, where they might have a tracheostomy tube. So they have a device that goes into their airway. Mm-hmm. And many a times this device can get clogged because of mucus plugs. And those can be life-threatening issues. One way that is addressed is you have these mannequins in which you can have devices very similar to that and have issues that might happen at home and show parents as to how to troubleshoot. But more importantly, for parents to actually practice on those mannequins. And that gives them a totally different level of comfort when it actually having to deal with their loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
This is their opportunity if mistakes were to happen. This is where they can do the mistakes and be able to learn from those mistakes and be able to do it the right way and learn to do it the right way.
Are the mannequins smart mannequins, so to speak? You know, if you get something wrong or if you do it right, you will be able to know from what the mannequin is doing?
Yes, there's a wide range in terms of the technology. And as we are learning lessons from other industries, this technology is getting better and better where actually the intervention that you do to the mannequin changes the appearance of the mannequin. These mannequins can go blue, can have increased work of breathing. They can change their dynamics based on what's being done. And that kind of gives the level of realism that parents can appreciate. It's as close to the real thing as it can be.
What have you noticed when you see parents interacting with these mannequins? Do you get the sense from seeing how the parents react that it's real for them? Like, is it as real as it can be for them?
It tends to be. Many parents are a bit shaken up after their first experience because they feel as if they are taking care of their baby while they are dealing with it. And actually, that kind of experience is where they are able to reflect on what happened and be able to understand the challenges that come with it and be able to learn from it.
Are there some situations, if you're training a new doctor, for example, where a simulator doesn't cut it, you just have to have a volunteer patient, otherwise you're not going to get the experience that you need?
Used to be the case, but as technology has improved, the mannequins are getting to the level of realism that would make the learners be better prepared, irrespective of the level of proficiency. For example, a medical student who is learning how to do a spinal tap on a little baby, just imagine the anxiety that might go in when they're doing it on a real patient. Now we have mannequins on which they can train, maybe do it several attempts before they feel comfortable with the procedure. Not only that, even as physicians and specialists who have done this for several years, we always can benefit from having several training opportunities because here you can train together as a team, be able to optimize the processes that are done and become better at what you do.
Do you get the sense that simulators are used more in children's hospitals or those kind of scenarios than maybe other medical settings?
No. Over the last 3 decades, simulation has been widely incorporated in different hospital settings, be it the adult hospitals or pediatric hospitals. And also now we are looking at opportunities where we can utilize simulation in other healthcare settings, be it the healthcare offices, the primary care offices. Also, recently at Nemours, we held a school health conference. Mm-hmm. This was for the school nurses, where we had about 100 school nurses from Central Florida that came together. And they had an opportunity to practice with these mannequins, situations that can happen in their school setting. For example, a kid having an anaphylactic reaction.
This is if you're allergic to peanuts or something,
yeah,
or
exactly.
Get stung by a bee.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And when a nurse is called to the patient's care, it's what they do during those first 5 to 10 minutes that determines the outcome in that scenario.
I've heard of the golden hour, but this is an even smaller window.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking a few seconds to minutes of being able to administer the life-saving medicine. And when this happens, when you're in a stressful situation, things can go wrong. But when you utilize the opportunity to practice in a safe environment and have a mannequin which resembles like a kid who's having respiratory distress following an allergic reaction to peanut, where you see a mannequin with actually a rash and swelling of the tongue, being able to administer the epinephrine to that mannequin holds them in good stead when something real happens in the school setting. And these happen at frequent intervals in school settings too. So it has a huge impact not only in the hospital setting, but also in the community.
Mm-hmm. Tom Baptiste, president of the National Center for Simulation, is there much of a crossover between medical simulation and a military simulation?
Absolutely. The Department of Defense has been kind of a leader in development of medical simulation. Now, the focus of what – because we've been at war in Afghanistan and Iraq for 12 years, the focus of what the military has done has been heavily focused on first responders, so combat right. medics. Mm-hmm. How do you stabilize a wounded soldier, get them to a field hospital, and then evacuate them to for recovery and rehabilitation? So, but that's changing as we come out of Afghanistan and Iraq. I see big opportunities for a lot of the effort by the Department of Defense to be aimed at patient care of soldiers' families. So that will increase the synergy between private hospital systems, civilian health care, if you will, and military health care. And I think there, we're going to see a big expansion in the use of simulation across both of those environments, and it's good for both.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about immersive situations a moment ago. Can you give us an example of one of those situations, and just how realistic are they for a trainee soldier?
Well, there's a program of record in the Army called Dismounted Soldier, and it is based upon a game-driven simulation with a head-mounted display, and it can train a single soldier or, as I said, a group of soldiers. And they can be immersed into an environment that perfectly replicates anywhere in the world. It could be an urban environment in a Middle Eastern city. It could be the jungles of the Philippines. It could be anything can be replicated in a game setting or an immersive environment. And they have avatars that represent the indigenous people, the good guys, the bad guys, the animals and other things that you might encounter. And so they can be immersed in that in this safe and secure environment in a room the size of this studio. Mm-hmm. So they don't need 10,000 acres of range space and live weapons and simulated targets and all that. It's all replicated in the immersive environment. And they can practice their craft over and over and over again.
Are there some situations, too, in military simulation where the actual job the soldier is doing isn't that much different? I'm thinking, for example, of drone pilots. You know, the training must be pretty similar to the actual job.
Well, if you're flying a drone, I mean, what you're doing on the console with a real aircraft airborne is nothing different than what the simulator would look like. Mm-hmm. So in that case, it's the real system is, easy to replicate. There are other things. Let me say one thing about simulation, and Robert talked about it. He was involved several years back, but when I started flying fighters in the early 70s, simulation wasn't very good. I mean, we're still in the analog era. And now that we've leapt into the digital age and the power of the computer has become so unbelievable, industry can deliver some really, really good stuff. So what we're doing now with simulation is suspending disbelief. It's no longer a carnival ride. It's a serious trainer. And if you can put a pilot in a flight simulator and make him come out of that with his heart beating fast and sweating, feeling like he'd just been put through a ringer, then you've really done something to improve the quality of that simulation and its contribution to his readiness as a combat-ready pilot.
Mm-hmm. Michael Schontz, Director of Technology and Analysis Design and Engineering at Disney, bouncing off what Tom Baptiste was talking about there, the immersive nature of some of these new simulations, is there a risk from a theme park industry point of view that simulation is going to get too good and maybe theme parks will lose customers? If you could have this experience in your own home, will people still go to theme parks for this kind of thing?
No, I actually think it's kind of the opposite. What you're going to end up happening is you're going to have the shared experience of that simulation environment. Certainly, we're already creating some of those kind of things. Remember when Disney envisioned the parks when he first started them, he wanted it to be someplace that he could be with his children, that he felt safe, and that would also be an enjoyment experience. And so the idea is to leverage these kind of technologies as much as we can and try to engulf that story and utilize that as much as we can. The other thing that we end up doing, just to follow on what Tom was talking about, is in our design space, we have an immersive environment similar to what he was discussing as far as our design space to be able to help design these. And it's called the Dish, and it's an area that's in a room and that you can walk in and then take a look at and see what we expect these new experiences to look like. It's a multi-display. You have 3D glasses and you walk around and you get an idea about what things are going to look like.
Mm-hmm. If you're thinking about people getting into this industry, into the engineering side of simulation, is it attractive for young graduates? Do people want to do this?
Yeah, we have a very strong intern program as part of design and engineering. We've hired a vast number I guess the best way to say it, of a number of our interns that have come out from that program. And many of the new graduates were part of the computer age as it came online. It is innate in the way that they think and do things. And so they love the intersection of computers and then using that in an engineering environment. It's something that they really seem to grasp a hold on and are some of our best engineers in that area.
Mm-hmm. Robert Abascal, CEO and founder of AVT Simulation. I want to come back to you for a minute. So talking about new graduates, people getting into the simulation business, who's your competition? Like who are you competing for talent?
Certainly the bigger companies that are in the area here, mm-hmm. Lockheed, Northrop Grumman, I'm sure I'm missing several, but there are several there who have huge institutional types of internship programs, very good opportunities for college students. One of our attractions is that we're very close to the university, so they can come from classes and within 5 minutes be working at AVT Simulation. So as a small business, I think we're a little further along than others as far as using interns. The program has been a great success for us, and the students have been very receptive.
And if you look outside of Florida, where are engineers looking to go? If they're not looking to Orlando, Central Florida, to get a simulation engineering job, where are they looking to go?
That's an interesting question. Certainly California has a lot of aerospace. When I left engineering school, I went to Texas, a lot of aerospace there. But as far as, you know, computer technologies, I would imagine Silicon Valley, more entertainment type, consumer type of environment. Here, there's a cross pollination of the military and entertainment, medical and commercial applications here. And so it's very attractive here for that type of skill set.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about simulation with Robert Abascal from AVT Simulation. And talking about funding for a minute, I mean, there's been some state funding for the National Center for Simulation, and also Orange County recently put in $100,000 towards the FireSpring Fund for educational programs and funding to early-stage technology companies in Central Florida. And the city of Orlando, as you know, is very keen to see more tech companies do well here. What else, Robert Abascal, do you think needs to happen to help keep the industry booming, keep it thriving?
I'm kind of indirectly aware of universities now that have all this funding for research through grants. A lot of great research is being done, but that they're actually licensing and commercializing that technology for commercial and industrial use. So that's a great opportunity to leverage the hundreds of millions and literally billions of dollars of research mm-hmm. that can be applied for commercial applications. So I think that's going to be a huge boon. UCF has a lot of research specifically in the simulation and modeling simulation arena. Mm-hmm. So I think there's going to be plenty of opportunities there to apply that technology now based on years and years and years of research.
Dr. Shiva Kaladindi, one thing you work with at Nemours is simulated skin. What can you tell me about simulated skin?
The application as far as simulated skin goes in healthcare, we have a suture program, an excellent suture program within our hospital. And when we speak of sutures and being able to be proficient as to how to bring a wound together, a laceration together, we use the simulated skin to be able to practice. There, you can practice as many times as you want, and we can do it in situ on a mannequin that looks like a patient. Utilize the simulated skin to be able to practice it. Not only that, be able to drain infections, be able to take care of minor procedures. This is our opportunity to utilize the technology that and the simulation from other industries. And these have gotten so good that recently, even when I practiced it, it felt real as the needle goes through this simulated skin. It kind of gives you a feeling of as if you're doing it on a real patient. So,
how often are you doing the traditional needle and thread sutures and not using glue or the little strips you can kind of tack on?
A good question. We look at the outcome. The main outcome is to minimize the scarring and also keeping in mind the comfort that is for the patient and, in this case, children that we take care of. So it's on a case-by-case basis. We want them to have a good experience out of the difficult situation that they're in. So when there's an opportunity to bring it with a tissue adhesive, the skin glue, we utilize that. And when appropriate, we utilize the suturing to be able to approximate these lacerations. So.
And talking about the immersive experience that Tom Baptiste was talking about, and also Michael Shontz. Is there a similar thing in the medical field? Like, could you strap on a set of goggles and be doing a surgery on somebody?
It's actually happening. Many of the surgical simulators, and even when you think of the real surgeries that happen, many of them are laparoscopic surgeries. Now we have the simulators which actually give you a feel of what you're doing, utilizing those laparoscopic surgical skills. So that is happening right now, and it's just getting better and better as it's getting to the realism of making it as close to the real experience as possible. And this is along the lines of how adults learn. When we learn, we need an experience. Based on that experience, we reflect on the experience and then see what we learn from it and apply that during the next experience. A simulation provides you that experience. As compared to doing the real thing, it provides you that experience in a safe learning environment where you can practice it and learn from it and apply it in real life.
Are you seeing it make things safer? Like, do you have some data suggesting that the use of simulators is leading to better outcomes for patients?
Yes, that kind of data is more recent, and it's more and more data is coming by. What we've seen is the reduction in catheter-based infections when simulation training has been incorporated as far as the training goes. But we have definitely seen an improved performance with their skills, improved performance as far as team training goes. And that is one of the things that we actually learned from the military industry or the Air Force, the crew resource management. When we think of errors and patient safety, what we've seen is communication is a big aspect of why errors can happen or ineffective communication. We've utilized this simulation training where teams can come together, practice on the team dynamics and the communication to optimize the care that's given to the patient. And when you practice several times as a team, when the real thing happens, and even when I worked in the emergency department, when we saw the real response when a sick kid was in our department, the response was optimum. And the reason that comes together is for the number of hours we put together training in that setting, utilizing simulation.
Mm-hmm. Michael Shontz, just want to come back to you for a minute. You're giving the keynote address at this conference in Orlando. Can you give us a little taste of what you're going to be telling industry insiders?
Yeah, I always like to say when I give this presentation, it's something that I kind of peel back the curtain a little bit to see how some of the things are done. I'm going to be showing some actual detailed mechanical models of some of our animated figures, what it looks like underneath some of those, what the rides actually look like when you have all the vehicles running at the same time. As you probably know, one of the things we like to do is have it be your experience, that you don't see the vehicle behind you, you don't see the vehicle in front of you. This way you'll be able to see the layout of actually everything that's going on in our rides at the same time. I'll be showing a transportation simulation that models all of our property. It's all multimodal. It's an agent-based where we have all the individual vehicles. They have certain dynamics about them. Some of them are more aggressive drivers. Some of them aren't as aggressive drivers. We have the monorails in there. So it's an idea to just kind of get a feeling of the application of all these different simulation technologies that we're using throughout the parks.
We've been talking to Michael Shontz. He's a director of technology and analysis, design, and engineering at Disney. Michael, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Also being joined by Robert Abascal. He's the CEO and founder of AVT Simulation in Orlando. Robert, thank you so much.
Our pleasure.
Dr. Shiva Kaladindi is a pediatric emergency medicine specialist at Nemours Children's Hospital. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Pleasure being here.
And retired General Tom Baptiste, president of the National Center for Simulation. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from Florida Hospital. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Join us again this Friday at 9 for the weekly news roundtable. We'll be taking your calls. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.